So it is my pleasure now to introduce Jo Aplin. She is a senior lecturer in the Department of History of Art at the University of York, where she specializes in European and American art of the 1960s and 70s. In 2012, she was a recipient of a Leverholm Prize. She also published two books that year, Eccentric Objects, Rethinking Sculpture in 1960s America. And the second book was Yayoi Kusama, Infinity Mirror Room, Fallis Field. In addition to journal articles, she has also written reviews and criticism for a number of journals and international publications. Her talk today, Down Tools, or Lee Lozano's Erasures, comes from her current manuscript project entitled Not Working, Lee Lozano's versus the Art World.
Lovely to be here. Okay. In April 1970, is that loud enough? Can you? Am I in the wrong seat? I'll sit nearer the microphone. Okay. In April 1970, the American artist Lee Lozano downed tools for good. With her final audacious dropout piece, Lozano stopped working, bringing to an end a decade-long career spent working as an artist in New York City. Almost immediately, she slipped from sight, omitted from the art historical account until only very recently, despite the considerable name she had built for herself as a leading conceptual artist and abstract painter. Dropping out was no picnic, however, as Lozano recognized. Shortly after embarking upon her exit from the art world, she wrote, "Dropout piece is the hardest work I have ever done." It signaled not only an end to all relations with the art world and its communities of artists, critics, dealers, and curators with whom Lozano had grown increasingly disillusioned. Rather, at its most extreme and ambitious, Lozano's dropout piece was an attempt to withdraw from the world entirely in order that she might begin to remake that world, to remake her world anew. Lozano had already experimented with such a withdrawal in her earlier conceptual artwork titled General Strike Piece. For the duration of her General Strike, which ran from February 1969 until sometime later that autumn, Lozano set about, these are her words, gradually but determinedly avoiding being present at what she described as any official or public uptown functions or gatherings related to the art world. Lozano's aim with these various refusals and work stoppages was, as she put it in a public statement, nothing less than a total revolution simultaneously personal and private. 4 months into Dropout Piece, Lozano embarked upon one further and this time final bombastic strike action, her boycott of women, during which she ceased all communication with other women. Although it was planned only as a six-month-long experiment, for the rest of her life, Lozano acknowledged other women only when absolutely pressed to do so. Waitresses, her friend Sol LeWitt would later recall, could expect Lozano to ignore them completely. After these final acts of self-negation, Lozano absented herself entirely. In 1972, she left New York City and the art world behind for good. During the 60s, Lozano was a permanent fixture in the downtown art world. Her work was included in exhibitions alongside Hannah Darboven, Eva Hesse, Marisol, Klaus Oldenburg, LeWitt, and Dan Flavin, to name just a few. Lucy Lepard would later describe her as the major female figure of conceptual art during the 1960s. In the autumn of 1970, just months before she began Dropout Piece, a solo exhibition of Lozano's wave paintings opened at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Lozano, it seems, left the art world just as she was getting started. Despite the brevity of her career, Lozano was prolific. Alongside numerous raucous and borderline pornographic sketches from the early 60s, which sadly I don't have time to go into today, she made over 100 drawings of broken down tools. just some examples here, and 50 or so large oil paintings, both of tools and later those purely abstract wave paintings, alongside scores of conceptual pieces. So here's just some examples of those paintings and drawings. Ideally, I would succeed in locating Lozano's strike actions and boycott within a narrative of the New York art world's politicization in the late 1960s. I would argue that Lozano's work refusal offered an early instance of what Kathy Weeks has described as a radical post-work imaginary that refuses the existing world of work that is given to us and demands alternatives. But as will become clear, Lozano had no explicit political agenda, nor did she have any alternatives to not working. Meanwhile, her boycott of women was the culmination of a fraught relationship with the women's movement, and it's difficult to reconcile her actions easily with a clear feminist position. Her refusals ultimately left her in a politically compromised situation from which there was no way out. However, to recognise Lozano's apolitical stance is not the same as claiming Lozano's practice was politically insignificant. Might we instead consider Lozano's work as enacting a kind of good enough politics? Lauren Ballant has asked, what does it mean for a movement or politics or social theory to fail? How might political breakdown work as something other than a blot or a botched job? This paper takes up the challenge posed by Ballant's question to ask what kind of political gesture might be discovered and what gains might be made in considering Lozano's botched social experiments, her boycott and refusal to work and dropout piece, as something other than outright failures. What, in other words, are we to do with an artist such as Lozano who disobeys, even disappoints? Might Lozano's bad feminism and good enough politics offer something in the way of a critical language with which to reapproach her multiple dropouts? How to deal with an artist who, on the one hand, has slipped from view in subsequent years and accounts of the 1960s, but who also, on the other hand, masterminded that very absence herself via that extreme act of self-negation? In 1963, Hollis Frampton took a photograph of Lozano's cluttered workbench, strewn with pots of brushes, stacks of paper, exhibition labels, books, and so on. Lozano sits centre frame in the shot, closely cropped in stark black and white, and surrounded by an array of mechanical oddments that have been arranged along the front of the desk in small clusters and rows. Items in the lineup include a chunky drill bit, a coiled wire spring, various cogs, screws, bolts, keys, clamps, sections of pipe, and even bullets. Frampton framed Lozano twice in the photograph, first in the camera viewfinder, and second in the large black blank canvas propped against the wall behind her. A portrait for now, the canvas will soon contain an oil painting of a workshop tool, a giant C-clamp perhaps, or a close-up detail of an unravelling screw. Or maybe it will be painted in waves and washes of thinly applied brushstrokes of brown, amber, or violet grey. For within the year, Lozano would begin to move away from figurative paintings of tools to produce a series of large, abstract, geometric paintings. While Lozano was not a sculptor, objects, tools, and other random things culled from her studio floor provided the source material for her numerous drawings and paintings in the early 60s. Light bulbs, clamps, crayons, wrenches, screwdrivers, thumbtacks, staples and drills recur repeatedly across paintings and sketchbooks in violent, erotic and ludicrous formations. I'm having to tear through them a bit here, but I hope you get a sense of them. In some drawings, twisted broken wrenches clamp onto wilting hammerheads and drooping screwdrivers slump and fall. These are tools that no longer work. They're locked into awkward postures, unproductive poses, and mechanical embraces as bolts fail to join, nails aren't hammered home, and screws miss their mark. Many of the items on her desk Lozano collected from the streets and hardware stores of Soho's Canal Street. a grimy, downtrodden and dirty site of run-down storefronts and hardware stores where she and her minimalist peers would scavenge for discarded materials and industrial offcuts. And in this sketch on the left here, she makes her feelings about the nature of Canal Street, renaming it Anal Street. It's a nod, too, to the gendered machismo of the contemporary art scene, and that other sketch makes this point plainly, that phallic spanner wedged into the pocket of a pair of men's jeans. In 1966, Frampton took a second photograph of Lozano's workbench. In this, Lozano is not depicted at work, but as absent, omitted from the scene entirely. There's something prophetic about this photograph, in which Lozano is substituted by her tools and working space, given that just 3 years later, she would down tools for good. Here, we're presented with a more contemplative scene than in the early photograph, in which Lozano has dropped out. Her art, or the materials of her art, now stand in for her. Many of the industrial knick-knacks, bolts, screws, drill bits, and other found objects included in that first photograph are present here in the second, this time dotted around as though a series of unwieldy paperweights. This is much more of a sort of bleached-out snapshot. It looks like this in the original, too. By 1964, Lozano's palette had toned down to equal that of her minimalist friends and peers. She produced a series of intense black, white, and gunmetal grey paintings of metal workshop tools. Several metres in length and height, the paintings were made using a stiff brush to produce thick, textured strokes, as though the surface of each has been combed. The flattened, pointed tip of a drill bit, its shining gleam picked out as though spotlit, fills this single panelled work. While in another diptych, a long black screw slides along the bottom of the pale grey canvas, the expected sharp tip curving and bulging indecently with that phallic form made overt in its final bulbous shaft. This is about 3 metres long. These are paintings about work and the labouring body, with the animation of one triggered by the other. But they're about other kinds of work too, the kind that is unproductive and non-generative. It's a kind of work that doesn't really work. Lozano deflates tools, at times through an over-the-top lampooning of their industrial, erotic, hard-edged aspect, and at others by softening screws, torquing hammerheads, and dismantling drills. In part, Lozano's decision to begin her general strike piece in 69 was triggered by an invitation to attend a meeting at Lucy Lippard's loft as part of Lippard's efforts to organise on behalf of the recently formed Art Workers Coalition. On the face of it, the Art Workers Coalition should have been a perfect home for Lozano's anger at the art world. The group's efforts rapidly expanded to agitate against the Vietnam War and to protest on behalf of the emerging feminist and civil rights movements in America. It seems then Lozano's adoption of a language of refusal was entirely of its moment. Yet rather than acting in concert with her peers, Lozano refused flat out to get involved with the communities of politically engaged artists and women gathering around her. Rather than stand up and be counted, she elected instead to stand apart. She noisily, angrily, and publicly declared her refusal to work, denouncing the coalition's activism and that of the affiliated women's groups. Lippard recalls Lozano announcing herself appalled during one meeting of women artists that she attended. Along with 60 other artists, including André, Frampton, LeWitt, and Lippard, Lozano prepared a written statement to be read aloud at the public open hearing of the Art Workers Coalition. Lozano's statement was a brief, single-sided polemic in which she rejected the idea of art world reform, demanding instead a wholesale overthrow of the entire system. Lozano wrote, "There can be no art revolution separate from a science revolution, a political revolution, an education revolution, a drug revolution, a sex revolution, or a personal revolution." She concluded by refusing emphatically the label art worker. Instead, she called herself an art dreamer. It's important that Lozano chose a public, open, and ostensibly collective event as the site to declare her refusal to participate. Lozano did not quietly withdraw her labour. She occupied instead a space of resistance predicated on an entirely public performance of not working. Furthermore, Lozano did not leave the art world and New York immediately, but slowly, deliberately, and publicly, maintaining a presence in the art world over the course of the long durée of her general strike. Unlike Andre Frampton and others, who used their statements at the open hearing as a platform to call for real material change through collective action and debate, Lozano's statement was no rallying cry, nor an attempt to galvanise her peers into mass strike action. Rather, it was a single instance of one artist speaking, of striking out alone. In this, Lozano's strike calls to mind the resistance of Bartleby, the eponymous hero of Herman Melville's novella, in which the Wall Street office worker states simply one day that he prefers not to work. The power of Bartleby's actions lies in his active resistance and performance of refusing to work, for he continues to show up to the office every day to instantiate bodily his refusal of labour, just as Lozano, for the duration of her strike, continued to be actively present rather than simply absent. Despite the seriousness of her endeavour, Lozano's tongue remained, at first at least, firmly in her cheek. She suggested in one instance a suitably bombastic soundtrack to accompany her strike would be that of Stanley Kubrick's 1968 movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. It says this just at the top. She kind of understood the drama of her actions. Lozano was not the only artist working in the gap between art and life, although we might argue she was one of its more outrageous practitioners. Nor was she the only artist of her generation to have dropped out or left the art scene at the dog end of a decade that had seen the countercultural movement encourage large-scale resistance to work, choosing instead to turn on, tune in, and drop out, in the words, of course, of Timothy Leary. Giving up art, changing tack, and dropping out has something of a mythic, heroic, even status. The isolated figure of the artist who lives outside of or unbound by the conventions of everyday life to make a dramatic exit. If then Lozano's dropout piece can be accommodated within an established modernist tradition of refusal and retreat, think of Marcel Duchamp famously and, as it transpired, not really, giving up art to play chess, what are we to make of Lozano's decision to boycott women? Lippard suggests that the emergence of the women's movement took Lozano by surprise, and that she, this is Lippard, rationalised her lack of political participation by turning away from the community to focus instead on her own individual identity and freedom, worked through in the privacy of her studio and via a range of personal actions. Joanna Burton has argued persuasively, I think, that Lozano's elliptical description of her various art-life actions demonstrated a search for the new honesty that echoed ironically the contemporary feminist movement's insistence on blurring the personal and the political. Other art-life actions by Lozano included her grass piece of 1969, in which she recorded her activities, first stoned and then not stoned, for a pendant no grass piece. And also Masturbation Investigation, another instance of Lozano's commitment to the solitary pursuit of individual pleasure, and she always writes them up in this format. As Burton points out, Carol Haneesh's famous polemic essay, The Personal is Political, argued that it was crucial the women's liberation movement try to understand the views of those apparently apolitical women who lived and worked outside of the movement, rather than attend solely to the views of those members already committed deeply to its aims. Throughout her essay, the question of good or right action is debated, specifically what can be considered to constitute a political act within the context of the feminist movement. For an intense period of time, any member of the women's liberation movement who is deemed to be putting the interest of the individual over that of the collective was roundly and aggressively trashed in public via smear campaigns and outright personal attacks. Despite the individualistic nature of Lozano's boycott and strike, and her own outspoken trashing of both the art world and often her peers, both male and female, whose behaviour she deemed to lack integrity, would suggest a certain affinity with the emerging radical feminist arm of the women's liberation movement that was by 1969 beginning to gain public and political purchase. Shulamit Firestone's call in The Dialectic of Sex for a dream action in the form of what she called a smile boycott against men lends a radical inflection to Lozano's boycott of women that registered and continues to register for some powerfully as too individualistic, too dogmatic and undialectical to either fathom or forgive. Certainly in the case of almost all of her female peers at the time, this is it's almost too much for them to talk about even now. There's a palpable anger. By 1968, Lozano had decided in no uncertain terms to reject the feminist movement. Writing across the page of a notebook in large capital letters, "I am not a feminist." Another entry would state, "Women's lib brought bad luck." The statement was written in the context of that meeting of women at Lippard's loft. Lozano noted angrily that the meeting was far from supportive, sisterly, or open. For Lozano, the disorder of the meetings offered the exact opposite experience to the dialogues she had been holding with various invited participants in her loft since 1969. Dialogue Piece was a long-running collaborative work aimed at producing conversations that privileged listening, openness, and mutual participation. Dialogue Piece began while Lozano was still in the process of extricating herself from the art world with her strike. It involved Lozano arranging a series of conversations with artist and curator friends in her loft. Lozano specified who she met and what the general topic or focus of their dialogue was, from discussing the shittiness of the art world with Bryce Marden to getting stoned with Richard Serra. Dialogue Piece stands as another portrait of the artist in her loft, and the list of people she had a dialogue with reads as a who's who of the New York art world at that time: Robert Moose Morris, Jasper Jap Johns, Marcia Tucker, Oldenburg, Michael Heitzer, Larry Wiener, Larry Poons or Poonsy, all make appearances in these informal one-on-one rap sessions. Lozano's slightly perverse take on the contemporaneous consciousness-raising groups in which women gathered together to narrate their personal experiences to one another as a form of political engagement. Lozano would make a careful record of all of the dialogues, including those she considered to have failed. She also charted a series of missed encounters with people with whom she hoped to have a dialogue. For a time, Lozano considered the feasibility of stopping all other work except the dialogues. She wrote, "What if I stopped doing different pieces and just did the dialogue piece for the rest of my life as my work? I could move to an exotic place and do it there. It has no space or time boundaries." In the middle of her general strike, Lozano would write, "The dialogues are a saying goodbye." Lozano's decision to stop working, to stop acting, and to stop talking to women, full stop, was politically motivated, utopian even for a time, even if it eventually led to personal breakdown, not political breakthrough. But to recognize the failings of Lozano's position is not the same as claiming Lozano's practice was insignificant, nor easily dismissed on the grounds of either bad taste or bad politics. I suggest we consider Lozano as testing the limits and enacting that good enough politics in which we see her reaching, striving, and attempting to make sense of the world, to make and remake it in such a way that she can imagine that world holding her. I want to nominate Lozano as one more example of what Jacqueline Rose has recently described as a scandalous feminism, one that embraces and takes seriously the darkness and failings, the emotional, psychic, and lived experiences of women that is important precisely because of its refusal to conform, to be reasonable and sane, an outrageous feminism that does not set out to sanitize, but to lay itself out on the table in all its sexual, mad, failed, and unreasonable forms. After quitting the art world, things never really picked up again for Lozano, and her life spiraled off in directions she hadn't ever planned. Her boycott of women was, of course, always bound to fail as a model of radical practice. It was every bit as counterintuitive and contrary as Lozano's shift toward large-scale abstract painting in 1967, at the tail end of a modernism already in the process of dematerialization, a transition in which Lozano was also paradoxically involved with her conceptual pieces. "Win first, don't last. Win last, don't care," Lozano declared across a page of her notebook. Rather than consider Lozano's decision to drop out as this definitive endpoint in her career, it is, I suggest, better understood as one attempt, one more attempt to go on, to wait out what Ballant describes as the impasse subjects often find themselves trapped within at politically difficult moments. In another context, it's worth bearing in mind Hannah Arendt's claim that the baseline of a political act is simply to be seen speaking, participating in debate within the public sphere, whatever the outcome. Lozano, of course, did just that. Just a year or two later, the emergence of feminism and the overtly political organization of the art world might have provided one context for Lozano's actions. However, and in Arendt's terms, of course, Lozano's refusal to continue to act, to stop speaking to women at least, effectively removed her from the political sphere, from the moment she ended all further participation or actions within it. Under the self-imposed conditions of Lozano's own withdrawal and refusal to join in, how could her actions be considered as anything other than a botched job or failure? How could dropout piece have worked out any other way? I just want to conclude by returning to Frampton's photograph of Lozano's workbench, in which the artist has dropped out of the picture, or perhaps momentarily stepped out of the frame. Piles of work papers and art supplies are strewn across the table, alongside other mundane items such as her cigarettes and matchbooks, the artist's spectacles, and an abandoned coffee cup. Art and life appear deliberately muddled up as though a material manifestation of the artist's own art-life experiments that would just 2 years later come to engulf Lozano's world entirely. Frampton did not capture the gap between art and life, but the impasse between working and not working. By a series of playful metonymic substitutions with the tools of her trade, Frampton's proleptic portrait of Lozano depicts the artist resolutely not at work. Perhaps she simply preferred not. As early as 1968, Lozano was considering alternative ways out of the impasse in which she found herself working in and for. She wrote the following: "It's not just that I find the local world less interesting. It's also that I find myself less interesting. I remain in New York City because it's one of the big idea centers. I wish to find the kind of work that will most engage my attention, whether it's painting, some other art, or something else entirely, I do not know." Within 2 years, Lozano made the decision to quit her local world completely. And bearing in mind the important call of this conference to make sense methodologically, politically, and formally of the various omissions, negations, and absences that constitute the histories of art, I just want to make 2 points which I'm hoping my case study of Lozano and her decision to down tools will make clear. The first is that we must continue to draw attention to those omissions from art historical accounts, and the once discredited process of recovery remains one powerful way of doing so, although this is not to suggest we simply slot lost subjects back into their historical moments. Such a strategy alone runs the risk of producing a series of minor or local histories that serves only to reassert the status of those figures and practices as outside and fundamentally different to those who make the final art historical cut. This disavows, too, the often accidental, sometimes politically or institutionally motivated reasons as to why some artists don't make it. Second, we must rethink the kinds of methodological strategies we have to hand that allow us to rethink those histories imaginatively and anew. Part of my aim with this project is to insist that in thinking with and through Lozano, her strikes, boycotts, and so on, new methodological and theoretical insights into how we go about ordering and reordering, writing and rewriting existing categories available for thinking about art and its histories might come to light. Scandalous feminisms, negative freedoms, things that go right as well as wrong, fail as well as succeed. In those moments of erasure and error, negation, omission and absence, might we not find other stories, other ways to account for and narrate this period of American art? Thank you.